Welcome to Agents of Smooch. Last year, I can't believe it was last year already, we assembled a group of agents to rewatch the original Matrix trilogy and talk about how it actually was a love story. We have reconvened our same group of agents to talk about the sequel, Matrix Resurrections. I haven't read a lot of reviews, but I suspect this movie will be controversial, as many sequels are. However, I do think that we are entitled to be a little smug today about some of our predictions in our previous Matrix episode. I am director Annette Weirstra, and for today's mission, we have reunited our crack Matrix team, including Agent Sarah Bickerston. Hello.
I'm sorry, have we met?
I do not know. It's probably under another name, under a different face.
Yes, different face, different name.
And we have Agent Sandra Wong. Hello, Sandra.
Hello, I'm plugged in.
Excellent. Agent Erica Ensign. Hi, Erica.
Hello. You know, being called an agent feels a little bit different when we're talking about it's Matrix true, movies. Right?
It's true. We're the good kind of agents. So, Matrix Resurrections. We go back to the Matrix, but 60 years later, with Thomas Anderson back in a cubicle, believing he is a game programmer. Trinity is now Tiffany and married to a literal Chad. As we revisit the beats of the original trilogy, we see some familiar faces and some that are sort of the same, but not in a way that sets us off kilter. And I'm going to say this is a sequel that is so self-aware, we might even call it sentient.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah, I like it. Well done.
I'm super curious because I was like, I really think that there's probably a lot of people who seriously dislike this movie. I feel like the first time I watched it, I had to watch it. We watched it twice within a couple of days because I'm like, I don't even know just what happened here. And I need to think about this because do I like it? I don't know if I like it. I can't tell yet. And so it took me a little while to figure it out. So, I'm really curious to know what all of you thought about this movie.
I was a fool. I will come out and say that the way that I planned this was very foolish. Usually I like to consume the media for a podcast, like close to the podcast, so I don't forget it. Somehow I kind of like just didn't realize, oh, right, this is a Matrix movie. So I waited until just this week. So it was just last night that I watched the movie, and that was foolish of me, because what I should have done was just watch it, you know, when it came out on streaming, so that I could rewatch it before the podcast, but I did not. So alas, I have only seen it the one time. But I will say, I was really impressed at myself how well I was able to keep up and follow things. I watched it with my spouse, Steven, who not a huge fan of the original three movies. He's seen the first one twice now and just like the second and third only the one time. So throughout the entire 2 hours and 27 minutes of The Matrix Resurrections, he had zero idea what was going on. He got to the end of the movie and he told me, he's like, I just at some point kind of realized that I needed to just sort of check out and just be like, I don't understand anything. He didn't remember anything from the first three movies. Can you imagine going into this movie and like having not seen the other ones or not remembering them? That was his experience. So I think he just enjoyed the pretty lights, and I had to explain the whole thing to him afterwards. But I was able to do it because, I don't know, like it hit me just right. So I'm excited to watch it again someday, but I think it was firing on all the cylinders I needed it to be firing on, that I was able to follow along and keep up with at least the big beats. Now, here is where, like, you guys explain stuff to me and maybe I find out I was completely wrong about a bunch of stuff. But so far, I think, A, I really, really, really loved it because I'm a sucker for anything that's that self-aware. And B, I think I followed it, which is more than I can say for the second or third movie the first time I saw them. So, yay.
I did tell a friend of mine was asking about watching it. I was like, you have to watch the first three movies before you watch this movie, because I don't think you could like watch it like 10, 15 years ago and then come and watch this even. I think you need to go in fresh.
And I have to say, I admire that because, like, there's always the, you know, when you're writing or reading a sequel, like, how much do you tell the people about the previous book? Like, do you expect them to just reread it and know it? Do you want to do a little bit of a recap? I feel like this movie did almost zero recap. And just like, I salute you.
Yeah, it was unapologetically, I mean, it was almost fan service in a way.
Almost?
It was fan service. I'm going to say that I loved it. Right from the get-go, right from watching it the first time, I sat down. This was the first, when I saw it late last year, it was the first film I'd seen in the cinemas for God knows how long it had been here in New Zealand that I'd been in a cinema. And that first chilling sound of that's the traditional Matrix sound. And I right from that get-go, I loved it. I preferred the first two-thirds of it, I think. The more cerebral, self-aware bits were the bits that I really loved. When it turned into a little bit more of a generic action flick that was a la the second and third films, I still enjoyed it, but it wasn't like top of the line for me. But yeah, I would consider this to be probably the second best of all four.
Yeah, wow. I completely agree with that. Yep.
Wow. I went into it. I totally wanted to love it, and I ultimately could not. So I've watched it twice, and I watched the first time, I don't know, whenever it was available, you know, for streaming. And then I just rewatched it two nights ago. And I really, really wanted to love it. And there are just too many things that were missing for me, unfortunately. I don't hate it, though. I know that Annette had made a comment that people either hated it, it seemingly, or they loved it. So after I, before I rewatched, I decided I would look up a few reviews. And it was, I only found like three. There's, you know, one from Rolling Stone, they raved. One from The Guardian, they hated it. And then another, it was RogerEbert.com, and they also hated it. So I just wanted to read what people were saying about it because I hadn't done any of that when I watched it the first time. And I didn't pick up anything new from the reviews. But watching it again, I did pick up a few more of those, what are we calling it, fan service moments, which I think were fun. And I really do appreciate that this film is really for fans. It's not for people who are coming to it new. Which is like, that's fine. That's great. But yeah, I don't hate it. I was just disappointed, I think.
My question for you is, you know, as a fan and as somebody who loved those first three movies so much, and you mentioned several times that you were going into it really hoping to like it. Was this a case of it, you know, this, they didn't make the movie that you wanted them to make and that let you down? Or were there specific things about this movie and the choice, you know, like, this is the movie that we have. Right. Are there specific things about this movie that just didn't work for you? Or were you just hoping for something different?
No, I don't go into films usually wanting it to go a certain way because I, as a writer and an author, I just totally understand that creative process, right? It's wherever the story takes you. I think that where it took the three writers, so Lana Wachowski, David Mitchell, and I always forget the third person's name, and I apologize for that. But the three of them took it in a direction that it was really uneven for me. So
it was Alexander Heman.
Thank you, Director Wistra.
That is Erica. That was Agent.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Agent I get Erica. Our voices mixed up sometimes when I'm editing.
I think it was uneven. And so at one point, like near that end, that climactic end, I was like, are we suddenly in a zombie film? This is weird.
It was zombie-ish.
It was a zombie film, yeah.
It was a zombie film. So when they were on the train and the whole swarm happened on the train, I was like, oh, is this like their homage to Train to Busan? Because they had like, you know, the East Asian kids in school uniforms and they're on a train in an East Asian country. And earlier than that, you know, when Bugs, they jumped through a door, Bugs and Morpheus, you know, it was kind of like Inception and like they were on the side of a wall and that whole thing. I thought, well, so maybe there's a few things where they're just playing around with different films and it's a bit of an homage. But overall, I just found it uneven. I didn't find the same philosophical meat, for lack of a better term, that I enjoyed from the original trilogy. And I found that the philosophical discussions, if we can call it that, were pretty superficial. And I thought they could have done more with that. So, yeah. And I don't want to turn this into like, oh, all the things I hated, because I don't hate it. I really don't. But I am coming into this conversation with you all wondering, like, I'm just curious, right, to hear what had you love it. So let's turn it to that.
I think you are right that the philosophical discussions in this movie, like it touches on philosophical stuff, but it's completely different. For the first movie, especially in the first three movies, were all about like the nature of reality and you know, what makes humanity human and that kind of stuff. And here, the philosophical discussion is something that's actually, nature of reality stuff, as I said on the previous podcast, I'm a sucker for that. I love it. It's one of my science fiction happy places. But one of my media studies happy places is thinking about media and how we consume it and what that does to us as, you know, as people in our brains and our hearts and all that sort of stuff. So the ideas that this one is engaging with are, yeah, maybe it is a little bit more superficial, but like I am engaging with the world on a superficial level these days. So it really worked for me. And the self-referential stuff was so, like, I just thought it was absolutely genius to have Neo hiding in plain sight and I appreciated that they didn't have him be like a movie director. He wrote three movies that were The Matrix. It was, you know, they turned it on and its ear, like 90 degrees. Like, it's a video game. And at first you think I thought it was just a game designer. He's doing some game called Binary. I was like, okay, that's interesting, because they're talking about the binary nature of, you know, choice and not choice and all that stuff. Yeah. Interesting. And then they're like, blah, 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 The Matrix. And I was like, wait a minute. So he thinks he's a guy who is just a game designer, and he game designed his entire life. That's a little Inception-y in just, you know, concept wise. And that hit me right there. Like, I love the idea of having him reinserted in the Matrix, although in this case it's like rebuilt and then reinserted in the Matrix, as we later find out. And being trapped in a completely different way than he was trapped in the first movie, even though it is exactly the same. And I will say, speaking of exactly the same, this movie had me from moment one, because it started off with those exact echoes. You know, I've seen that first movie so many times. I was like, I had to whisper to Steven and be like, this is exactly the way the first movie was shot. This is how it started. And except that it's different actors, but they're giving the same lines and it's framed exactly the same. And then suddenly you have Bugs, who is watching through like the holes in the wall. And I was like, that's us. We're watching. Mm-hmm. It was very, you know, on the nose, but in a way that worked for me so well.
Yeah, I will completely agree with that. It shifted from the nature to reality to the nature of media. And so previously we were asking questions, we're supposed to ask questions about the nature of reality and what's real and what's not real. To a certain extent, they put all that aside. What's real and not real? I mean, I think even Morpheus made that comment, like, who cares to a certain extent what is real or what is not real? They made the point, it shifted to representations, and you'd get these multiple layers of media of referring back to each other. And this one that's like, we're constantly telling the same stories. And that's a reference that, like, we have the same basic story plots that exist within Western society, and we're telling these same stories over and over and over again. And that's a direct reference to The Matrix being the same story that has been told before. And yet, it's like, now it's a sequel. Lana Wachowski overtly names Warner Brothers,
yes,
as demanding a sequel. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was genius, because are they talking about the game sequel or the movie sequel?
I actually read She is talking about the movie sequel, that scenario is essentially what happened. It was like, we're going to make a sequel and you're going to be involved, or we're going to do it without you. So that whole thing is a commentary about how movie studios and productions are working. And yeah, so I was like, oh, that's super interesting.
I wondered that. And I like, mm-hmm. as that sequence sort of progressed, I was more and more convinced that that really was the case, because it came off as angry. Like all of the sequences where they're just sort of like, you know, workshopping, like, what are we going to make this next game be? Like, they were, that was raw. Like, it was funny. Like, I giggled at some of the lines, but I was like, this is coming from a woman who is pissed off. Like, righteously pissed off about having to do this. But I felt like she did a good job of, pulling the best out of it as possible, because, you know, and it was also interesting the way that they split the difference between, it's 60 years later, but the actors are only 20 years older. It's just like, wow, you really thought about this a lot.
You could tell she was angry. I don't think she wanted to write this. Initially, but yeah, it was a commentary on media, and because there's a whole bunch of points where a number of the actors, possibly Morpheus, I think it was, they're talking about things being co-opted and stripped of meaning, and being turned into commodities, and then they were talking directly about the red pill, blue pill construction in the background of talking about this, like, meaning being stripped away and depth being stripped away. And I think that was directly her referencing the way in which red pilling became taken over by the far right in the US. And I think Ira's right. She's angry, and she's making commentary on media. Forget the nature of reality. She's making a comment on the nature of media, both in itself as media, but also the industry. That's the stuff. Was like, ooh, she's going somewhere else, because right at the beginning, Bugs said when she offered Morpheus the pills, and she goes, I know, right, that's a binary choice, but then I realized the choice is an illusion, and I've already made the choice, it doesn't matter. So she's immediately throwing away this concept of, is it real or is it not, it doesn't matter.
I like that too, that meta narrative that they put in there about being forced as a creative artist, being forced by the suits to make them more money. And are you prostituting your vision as an artist, or are you able to create something new? And can you create something new when someone's twisting your arm to do it? So I caught a little bits of that, like in lines of dialogue, like I think, of course I can't remember who said it, but I wrote down in my notes, why use old code to make something new? And that was when they were talking about the modal that Neo has created. And I was like, okay, I get it. There's a meta narrative going on about creating something, you know, 20 years after you thought you were done with it, which I appreciated. But I did want to jump on the mention of your mention of the red pill, Sarah, is I wanted to know if you all felt like Lana Wachowski in particular has taken back, you know, the red pill and what it means. Do you think that there is a commentary about, like, not commentary, excuse me. Do you think that she was like, well, I am, you know, reappropriating this term?
I mean, I think she was trying to. I don't think she will actually succeed, because language does what language wants. And as long as jerks are using that terminology, there's no way to take it away from them. So I do feel like that was her sort of spitting in their faces and being like, this is a thing that I came up with and I am using it the way that I want to. And, you know, screw y'all. So I do think that that was definitely the intent. But I don't think, especially, you know, since this movie came out during a global pandemic and not as many people went to see it as would have otherwise, it's not going to become a part of the cultural zeitgeist. You know, taking back of it is not in the way that I think we all wish it could be, unfortunately.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that 100%.
Mm-hmm. I think, like, when we talk about the anger, I think part of that anger for me came from that sort of co-opting of what I think she and they, like, her and her sibling thought they were telling one sort of story, and it was completely co-opted for basically the opposite reason. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you have the scene where everyone's talking about what the Matrix means, and you have the, like, it means this, this, and this, and this, and it's like it means anything anyone wants it to be. And we also see sort of like a lot of things around perception, and I love the fact that when, like, Neo or Trinity looks in the mirror and they see who they feel they are. And like Chad mm-hmm. says, of course you don't look like the person that was like, that character is not mm-hmm. based on you. Don't be ridiculous, because he's seeing like someone you. Else. And when you see the reflections, there's so many reflections mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where the reflection was not the mirror of what we were seeing. Yes. And sort of that dysmorphia of how other people see you versus we see ourselves. And it all that to me kind of linked in with that concept of red pill, and just in general mm-hmm. that everyone was seeing what they wanted to see out of this movie, and, well, not this movie, but the original mm-hmm. Matrix mm-hmm. and interpreting, which then links back into those critiques and thinking around the media is like, we're all seeing what we want to see in the mirror, but it might, and it almost left me going, like, is the characters we're seeing from the original movie, are they actually, those are the actors that were in the game, versus the characters we're seeing in these movie is what they actually look like, or is it the vice versa? Ooh. I don't know who is I did find, like, I don't understand what I'm seeing, and if I'm seeing the right, like, you know, it doesn't matter because it's all perception, and reality is mm-hmm. it's almost meaningless. So yeah, it was just interesting. Well,
I think you're hitting upon something I wanted to bring up for sure, Annette, which is much more so than in the original trilogy. There's this thematic element of mirrors being windows mm-hmm. being mirrors. And so reflections, are they reflections? Are they refractions? Are they windows into, you know, something insightful? And I really appreciated that. I think it also tied in for me other themes of, like, facsimiles of masks/faces is what I have in my notes. So and then also for me, like, another thing that also ties into those themes is a theme of binaries. Mm-hmm. That is, like, so big in this entire film. But at the same time, I found that they handled that theme pretty inconsistently, which was something that was, like, not quite working for me, unfortunately. But I think that that could have been really, really I would have been somewhere I would have been more interested, I think, in going with the film. But I totally get it, right? I'm not the filmmaker. I did not write it. So, yeah. But for me, I think that would have been more interesting.
Mirrors were also doorways. Because mm-hmm. that's their mm-hmm. entry and exit point to the Matrix, is instead of the phones, it's with the mirrors.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I actually agree with that on two points, Sandra. We got one, Neil Patrick Harris's, the first time we see him, he's wearing glasses.
Oh, those blue glasses.
But blue glasses. Yeah. So it's not just a frame, a glass, a reflection on the world. They're blue glasses, reflections, framing of the world. Mm-hmm. And you see him sitting there, and there's a blue butterfly over his left shoulder, and you see these kind of references. So that point about, like, the windows, the reflections, the portals, the frames of the world. Yeah, that was throughout it. And I particularly thought the framed glasses the blue frame of the glasses was such a powerful metaphor there. Mm-hmm. And then also there were moments where they were really trying to circumvent the binaries that were so present in the first three films. They mm-hmm. were like the binaries were everywhere. And there were the moments where it was like, I thought they were trying to circumvent binaries, but they didn't, like, take the next step. And I was like, I just mm-hmm. want that, just that little bit more. And the way in which they seem to be, that the possibility, the potential to circumvent, to deconstruct binary constructions was was on the tip of yep. just on the tip, just take the next step, come on. And no, they didn't. And that was what my part where I was like, oh, I wish they'd just gone that little bit further
yeah.
with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a thing that I do agree with. That was like there were enough moments where it seemed like they were sort of, you know, hammering the binary thing home. Like they named his game that. They talked about how you know, Neo and Smith were yoked together, and they actually, you know, turning that connection into a chain, and that is how they were trapped in the first place. Like, you know, that mm-hmm. binary between them, and yet. It, you're right. It never quite makes it up over the top of that hill. It's just sort of like they go, well, but now we're more interested in this thing or that thing. But, you know, one of those other things that they were more interested in was the romance, which is, you know, that's why we're all here. And I, like, as I said in the last one, like, it took me a couple of watches of those first three movies to really get the romance between Neo and Trinity, and it did not take me three watches of this movie to get that. It was right out there, and yeah. I was like, yeah, this is celebrating what was sort of hidden away in that first one.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I just need to make a comment on Carrie Ann Moss, and oh my God, she's so gorgeous in this film. Mm-hmm. Just so stunning. So stunning. Yeah. And you know I'm a huge Keanu nerd fan, and still.
Yeah, I finally get it. I was actually thinking in this movie, I was like, you know, I remember, you know, Sandra just loves Keanu so much. And I was like, yeah, you know, a lot of people do. And I watched this movie and I was like, oh, now I see. It just took this movie for it. So if nothing else, yes. I'm on the same wavelength now.
Oh, welcome, my sister. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, God, can Carrie Ann Moss wear a leather jacket? Just casually. And you're like,
her performance is so good because she's, you know, she's not just wearing a leather jacket. She's wearing the, you know, persona of a middle-aged mother, but that's not really her. And she does such a good job of being this, you know, kind of cool mom type who also, especially when they're having that conversation where you see the reflection of her in the table and it's mm-hmm. not really her, mm-hmm. and talking about how angry she is at Chad, who is like, he is literally a Chad, because the guy that mm-hmm. plays Chad mm-hmm. is named Chad, and she's totally cool, but then when she starts talking about how angry she is that he laughed at her, and actually how angry she is at herself that she laughed along with him, which I thought was a very nice touch on the script front, like it comes out, but it's just not over the top. It is perfectly played. Like, she's walking this tightrope of I'm this other person, but deep underneath I'm still Trinity. But I can't let that completely show. It just, I was very impressed. One of the things that I was kind of disappointed by was the fact that we didn't really get to see much of Trinity until the end. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, well, you know, they have sort of replaced her with, you know, the whole cavalcade of really amazing women and people of color. So I wasn't super annoyed that we are, you know, that she's the princess who has to be rescued, especially given what happens at the very end, which was not unexpected, but made me very happy. But I was a little bit sad because, you know, watching the trailers and stuff, I was really excited to see Neo and Trinity, and we really got Neo, .. and Trinity.
Yeah.
So, like, that was a little bit sad for my heart. And, like, I recognize this is the story that they chose to tell, and I respect that. But it would have been nice to see our super hot Trinity mm-hmm. doing super hot stuff a little bit more.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen her home life and the tensions, as much as we were the great scenes that we were seeing for Neo and the conflicts that was occurring in his Groundhog Day approach to life. I would have liked to have seen a little bit of that for Trinity too.
Mm-hmm. Well, they allude to a little bit, and I think this would build on what would be nice to see is, instead of telling us, showing us how she says, at some point in the movie. I don't know if I had children because I'm supposed to have children or because I actually wanted to have children, which makes super sense when she didn't choose any of this, right? They just constructed this whole world around her. And so there's this tension of this isn't really what she wants, but she's just sort of in the middle of it and she can't remember choosing it because she didn't choose it.
It's a commentary, right, about a certain kind of woman in this patriarchy that we live in, and women being sort of like, what is that? That's really more like second wave feminism, coming awake to the idea that, hey, these are roles that someone else prescribed for me, and I'm just going through the motions. So that's what came up for me about that.
Yeah, I was going to mention something similar in the sense that it's also a very 40-something, 50-something thing to be thinking. It's like, I'm at this place with my life and I'm just asking myself now, why am I doing this? Am I doing this because this is what I'm supposed to do? Is this my life? Why is this my life? And that's questions that I think like a 40 or 50-year-old someone can actually go, yeah, that resonates for me. That's a question. Have I done all this? Have I settled down with a family and a partner in the burbs? And this is what I was supposed to do, but I'm now at a point in my life where I'm like, did I want this or not?
You know, I did appreciate that the binary of asking the either or and like leaving space for the fact that, you know, some women do want to have children. Like, is this a thing that I did because I wanted to? You know, the piece that did not work for me was the anger at the name Tiffany. Like, I have a thing about names. Names are so important to people. And the idea that, like, okay, yes, Tiffany is not the same as Trinity, but it is a name that really, it just, you know, it's not maybe as stereotyped as Karen is right now, but it has like this very specific kind of, you know, a woman who's maybe not particularly bright and she just kind of goes along with whatever. And I hate that that's a thing. And I really did not appreciate that they were sort of leaning into that and that they sort of made it a joke. So that was a little bit uncomfortable for me just in terms of the way that they framed that. But the everything else about it, I thought was great.
One of the things that put me off kilter a bit was I couldn't decide if I liked them actually inserting as much of the movie, the first movie and the other movies, into the story as they did. And because it's a very long movie. there was a point, and I was like, I think I agree with Sarah when she said the first two were humming along. And then there was a point where I was like remember when we talked about how the second two movies probably could have been one? And I was like, they could have tightened this one up too. Yeah. And the first two thirds of the movie, I think I like the parts when they're in the Matrix more than outside of the Matrix.
Yeah, I'll agree.
So I was just wondering, because like that's a way they could have they played a like very long passages from the first movie.
Yeah, weren't they like, I know this was just yesterday that I watched it, but weren't I thought that most of the time that was happening, it was happening behind them on a screen or at the same time as somebody else is talking about it, and or flashing back and forth between the actual scene from a movie and somebody else saying those same words.
Yeah, it wasn't like a full-on just like replaying it, but it just seemed like a lot.
Yeah, I never felt like the movie came to a screeching halt to fit that in.
Right.
And I guess maybe I liked it just because I love those movies so much. So every fan service.
I just couldn't decide. And I think it's grown on me. But the first time I saw it, that was the most off-putting thing for me when I watched it.
Yeah, I didn't like it. Same. I wouldn't say that I was like, oh my God, I hate this part. But I was like, I'm not sure about this as an artistic choice the first time I watched it. But just this second time, it did feel more streamlined. So I'm not sure what changed, but something changed. And I thought it worked better.
Do you think you would have liked it better or worse if they had not had the conceit of it having been a game? Apparently a game with, like, the greatest graphics ever, because
I think the game made it better. Like, the fact if it had been a game or a movie or something that we were consuming that existed. But I do like that they picked a video game, because of that felt very coding and fit into the world better, I think, than a movie would have. But
I actually also think it, like, thematically, in terms of the character of the analyst, it fits with his snide snobbery, right? That it would be nothing but a video game. Like, that would be his take on it. And that's why he would choose that for Neo's, you know, Thomas's new life, quote unquote. So
my thing is that I don't think the IO scenes were necessary. I liked them. They were gorgeous. I mean, I'm never going to turn down any Jada Pinkett Smith ever. I did like some of the binary circumvention where the some of the sentience and the machines were now on their side. So that was a little, that was good. But I just felt like the amount of time they spent in IO, when merely they were just pivot points, it's like nothing really happened in IO. And so I was like, why are we here? And so that was, if anything could be cut, it would be those scenes, because I felt like some parts of Matrix Reloaded were being shoved into the original Matrix film in a way for this, that I felt it didn't need it.
I, you know what, I agree, but I also completely disagree, both, because I found myself during the beginning of the movie, which I was very much enjoying, like, what is going on, I'm trying to figure this out, but I also found myself during a big chunk of the front of the movie going, okay, but this is a 20 years later sequel, I want to know what happened in those 20 years. I have found myself being very curious about, okay, so at the end of, you know, the previous Matrix, they were going to let people leave, and, you know, they had saved Zion, and, like, so what happened in between there? So, and the only times that I really got an answer to that were the IO scenes. And I think that, yeah, they were long, and I don't feel like quite enough happened, but they did give me really important things. The, like you already mentioned, Sarah, the fact that the machines, some of the machines are already on our side. That was a huge, huge deal for me. I've always been fascinated by stories of artificial intelligence and all that kind of stuff. And I was, you know, really interested in the evolution of Agent Smith in the first three movies after I had seen them a couple of times. So now coming to the fact that, like, you know, what did Neo actually accomplish? Well, one of the major things that he accomplished is setting the machines up to recognize that they're not machines. What are they? Yes, that was really important to me, that we now have other characters, including Morpheus, who is totally a synthient now too. So you had that, and then you also had the, just like, I wanted to know what the heck happened to Zion. And yes, I know maybe growing strawberries isn't that exciting, but I thought it was great.
I think that the IO scenes, okay, scenes in IO and telling us what happened in the 60 years since Neo died, I think that is important. I just think that they didn't write it very well. I think that's what didn't work for any of us, is they could have written it much better, and they just didn't. The scenes weren't up to task.
There, you know what? That actually makes me think there were some places where I did feel like I was just getting an info dump and sort of being lectured at. So, like, between those scenes and the scene later when Neil Patrick Harris is going so much faster than Neo as he's trying to run across the room and stop the bullet, like, I was just like, okay, you're lecturing me, dude. I think that maybe that is one of the weaknesses. It leans on explanation.
It was a villain monologue, for crying out loud. It was literally a villain monologue.
Going as fast as Neo.
And it was going as fast as Neo. And that was like, oh, God. There's like, I think there's one reference that Niobe makes to the machines turning on each other in a war. And it was like this little one-handed reference with a slight flashback of machines shooting at each other. And I was like, wait, I want to know more about this.
Yeah.
It's like exactly that point that you made, Erica, about like, wait, did they, like, when did us become them? And for machines. And that was one bit where I was like, I want more about this. But I know, not my story. So,
I thought the fact that they had to like lock up Neo and create that sort of controversy and stuff and tension. And I was like, I didn't really see the point of it. I thought but why are we?
It felt like
this?
A Doctor Who story from the 1970s.
He was literally imprisoned for 30 seconds. Yeah.
So we could have skipped that and fit in some more stuff, right? Because nothing really happens, right?
Yeah, they locked him up just so they could like rescue him 5 seconds cool later.
Five seconds later. Mm-hmm. It
seemed like they were leaning really hard on the, you know, the choice thing, and it's like we kind of are. There are so many other points in the movie where we really get that choice that you didn't necessarily need it to be shown to us by, you know, the Bugs and her crew coming out again and making that choice again.
Yeah,
it's like they already made the choice. The choice is an illusion.
Yeah. I loved Jessica Henwick, I'm going to say, as Bugs in this. Mm-hmm. She's great. Right.
I just want to go watch everything with her right now.
Yeah, I know. I mean, like, I feel like we've done a disservice that we're like half an hour, 40 minutes into talking about this. And we're just mentioning her because she was, I loved her. And, oh God, 20-something-year-old me would have had such a crush on her character. It's like, and I'm head-canoning. There are a couple of scenes between Bugs and Lexi, who's her woman number two, where I'm like, they're a couple.
Absolutely.
Totally are.
They're 100% a couple. It was like the way she got to Lexi in the car when they were being swarmed in the final scenes. They're a couple. And that's I will admit, I tweeted at the actress who played Lexi to ask that if that was the case. She didn't respond, which I think is a perfectly valid thing not to do. I headcanoned those two as a couple, totally 100%. But no, I loved Jessica Henwick in this role, and she was us. She was us the entire way through.
Yeah, because she's the one that starts the movie by, you know, watching through the wall and being like, this is what happened. But, you know, if this is what happened, that's not the way it happened. And I was like, yes, that's right. That is how it happened. But it's not quite how it happened. And that didn't happen on the roof.
Well, and it took me a second watching it to go, is that actually clips of the movie? And then you realize, like, no, that is not the same. That is not the same person. And what I loved is that. Yeah. And but you start, because the thing a lot of us love about The Matrix is it like blew our minds. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I think they kind of played with some concepts to try and like set you off from what you were expecting this to be, like a more straightforward movie, which was fun.
The actress that they got to play Trinity in the modal in that first scene, that obviously made a deliberate choice to pick someone that kind of looked like Carrie Ann Moss, but not really. So it was like it's close enough to have twinges of that going on, but she's not really Carrie Ann Moss at all. They didn't even like, they possibly could have found someone that looked closer to her. And that was, so I was constantly having this like dislocation in my brain with it. It kind of is, but it's not. Even from behind when they have that shot when they first come into the room and she's sitting at the desk, my brain was like, this isn't right. Mm-hmm. Nope, it doesn't look right.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to point out too, that they just changed the elements enough so that it was, we're off kilter. And that's a term you've been using, Annette, about this film. So like the outfit of the modal Trinity, totally different. She has like eyelets all the way down her back and all over her outfit. The room is a different size. It's a different, the walls are different. And so everything was like, that's not quite right. The heart of the city sign that's outside, you know, the wrong letters missing or not lit. And so it's just a few, you know, just those little details that are askew. And so I think that's supposed to, that's actually, so I, this is also getting into something I wanted to ask all of you about, which is the modal is created and coded by Neo, and he has elements in there that just are symbols. They symbolize his mental state. So he has signage in there, like there's the sign at one point, I think it's Spanish, sabor a mierda, and I don't speak Spanish, so it's terrible. Pronunciation, but that basically means taste like shit. And you know, the sign that Bugs, she falls down the side of a building, a neon sign, it says Anderson's, like it's a pub. Oh. There's like a martini olive for the O, but then there's a little sign at the bottom of that right before she lands on the ground, which says for people who like to eat shit. So it's like these little things throughout this modal that show you that Neo is, once you figure out that he's the one who coded it, he's maybe not in a great place.
Yeah, and you actually see those signs later too, when you can see his game over his shoulder, like on his monitor. Yeah. You actually see the Anderson's and the sign on there. So it's like it may not even be in just the modal, it may be in the entire game. Like that right. is how he has coded this binary
right.
Game.
Yeah. And so for me, I wanted to ask, like, I wanted to have a bit of a conversation about the depiction of mental illness, because that's a big part of, that's how the analyst shows up, right? Mm. As a faux therapist. And like the use, how the script weaponizes, mm-hmm. you know, the terms about mental health and mental illness it's like really, it's kind of enraging. It's infuriating because you know people who use those terms, and they use them in a way that's mean and cruel, the same way that the analyst does to Thomas or to Neo. But anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about that, about like, what did you feel about this depiction of mental illness, of what, you know, the Thomas Anderson is going through when he's trying to be Neo, but he can't because he doesn't know who he is.
I thought it was insidiously good because, I mean, like you said, the language is, that's all real language. And while the analyst is absolutely weaponizing it, that's also the kind of a conversation that you could expect a real caring analyst to have with a patient who is disassociating from reality, which then just feeds right into it. Like, I literally was having a few moments myself going, okay, like this all of these things that he's saying, they make sense. Like I find myself wanting to trust Neil Patrick Harris and his blue glasses because all of these things make sense. And you know, maybe the whole real mind screw of the fourth movie is the fact that none of it was ever actually real, and Thomas Anderson, the game designer, is actually the real character that, you know, created all three of the first movies that we loved so much, and there is nothing outside of the Matrix, and that was all just a dream. And like, so it not only weaponized the language of therapy against Neo as a character, it weaponized it against me as an audience member, because it had me almost believing the same thing. And you know, I think I was so wrapped up in the film and trying to figure out what was going on that I didn't really take a step back to think about it from the perspective of a person with a mental illness, with several, and think about what that says sort of about mental illness in our culture. And I think one thing that it says is just that it's kind of, I'm taking away a little bit of a positive from this, is the fact that we are now having open conversations about mental illness, and people talk about it, and it's not a thing to be hidden away like it was like when I was a kid. So much so that these are terms and concepts that are in the zeitgeist. People understand them. People who are going to see movies for action and fun are not going to get lost listening to that part of the script, because people know those terms. People know that stuff now. Therapy is not something to be feared and distrusted anymore. So now that I'm thinking about it, I guess it was fascinating, and I'm a little bit happy that it was even in the movie, because that means that we have come a long, long way since I was a child and not knowing what to do with my poor, sad brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think to a certain extent, like, Thomas Anderson wasn't stigmatized for going to therapy. It was just a matter of fact that if you had a person doing that, going to therapy and doing this kind of thing, it was matter of fact. It was perfectly reasonable. That one, in a way, was its power, because it was totally reasonable that these things would occur. The fact that the analyst was gaslighting him the whole way through.
Not great.
Yeah, great.
But he is the villain.
But he is the villain. Yeah, and the fact, but the mere fact that, like, so much of that was totally reasonable, totally rational. How many of us would have gone, yeah, that makes sense to an analyst who said those kind of things, particularly if he goes, we don't use that word here. That, yeah, it was, it just was matter of fact that of course you'll be in therapy.
I agree with that. I do. It does hit a pet peeve of mine, which is medication.
Ah.
So I talk about this when I think we talk in the main show about The Magicians does this. It comes up so often in TV shows and media that taking medications is bad. And because you've set up the red pill, blue pill, it's like the blue pill that is helping him in this context is like keeping him in a state of denial and cutting him off from his true self and all that stuff. And it's like, yes, but some people actually really need those medications to be their true self or to find their equilibrium. So like, it's another example that it's like, it's so rare to actually see a positive depiction of someone using mental health medications and treatments like that in a neutral or a positive way. It's almost always in media portrayed as something that's sucky. So like, I'm like, oh, you've set up this metaphor and now you've totally like used it against using mental health medication.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a
great
point.
That is an excellent
It's not just this. It's like it's all it's the everywhere. Time it happens. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there are like at least and you're right. I'm not going to give this movie an entire pass for that because I think it's just doing it as a matter of course because it is everywhere.
It's so
like
typical.
You said.
Yeah.
But at least we do have it balanced out with yes, they're blue pills, but we do have red pills as
it's
well.
It's true.
And it's not mental health medication, but it's not like the movie is anti-pill. I guess is all I can give it.
Yeah.
But we see so many blue pills and only like a couple red pills.
I know. But like, can you imagine, can you imagine the temptation as the creators to be like, okay, this is how we have structured it. You know, he thinks he's somebody else. He's seeing an analyst, et cetera, et cetera. And you have from the first movie, the red pill, blue pill thing. Like, I'm not sure that I would have the strength, even as a person who does rely on both pink and blue pills to survive. That I'm not sure I would be able to like resist the temptation to just use that because it's such a great image, even as bad as it is overall.
Shall we like go back to the romance side and like
absolutely
pat ourselves on the back for everything we kind of were predicting? Because like when I watched it, I was like, oh, we were right. Like so much of it, we were right. And if I'll put the link if you did not listen to our first episode, but pat ourselves on the back.
Yeah, the one major thing that really hit me was that. You remember back in that previous podcast episode, I mentioned that like I got with Neo being the one and I got Trinity being three. And I remember saying at the time, oh God, I can't, what's the two? And we were floating some possibilities around what might be the two. And it just hit me during this film. The two are Trinity and Neo together.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
the power.
Yeah.
That's maybe I'm retconning it or Lana Wachowski is retconning it to a certain extent, but the two of them together, because remember the analyst mentioned that like whenever they touched hands in the real world, it completely screwed everything up and he had to go back to the beginning again. And that was the power of them together as two. But I'm taking that retcon. I don't care. that we have the one, the three, and the two. And
you know what? That actually makes me feel, once again, I'm pretty sure I thanked you last time too. Thank you, for pointing that out, because that really makes it easier for me to enjoy the end of the first movie where, you know, she kisses him and suddenly he comes back to life. And it's like, well, you know what? If that's the way that this works between the two of them, when they touch, magical things happen. Well, yeah. I guess that's what happened at the end of the first movie.
That's true. There you go. Yeah. There you go. So, I mean, the other thing for me too about the love story that, you know, I was campaigning for the entire trilogy is that basically this film is like, Resurrections is like, it's like a massive midlife crisis. It's really,
oh, it totally is. Right? Yeah, yeah.
So then like, what is the answer to your midlife crisis? If we're going to take it from this film, the answer is, you know, get back to who you are truly, who's your true self, and then remember who you love, remember who loves you, and reconnect with them. Like, that sounds so trite, but I mean, and then together you'll be more powerful than apart. Like, it's just horrible, but also that's like romance, man.
Yeah. I have typed out, love is the answer.
It worked on me just so whole hog. Like the scene toward the end where they're being held apart by all of the cops and stuff, and they're reaching out and they're reaching their hands, and then, you know, the music is starting to swell. Like, that was, I think, the first time that I started to like cry in this movie. Aww. And like and I swear to God, this is absolutely true. They're reaching and they're reaching, and the very moment that their fingers touch, speaking of taking medication, I have an alert to take my medication at the same time every night, and it's on silent. So when that happens, my Fitbit just like wiggles on my wrist. The very second that their fingers touched, my wrist went as if someone was touching my hand, and I lost it. Like, I was already starting to cry, but at that point I was just like, insert adrenaline, outcome tears, and it was like that. The rest of the movie, I was head over heels. It was perfection.
Wow.
Yeah. The funny thing was, because a little while ago, and this is getting into a bit of geekery, I managed to track myself down a second original HomePod, because I've got an original HomePod and wanted to try to get a second one. And so I did. I managed to track it down, and I've now got them set up as a stereo pair off my Apple TV. And the great thing about having a stereo pair of original HomePods is that they do Dolby Atmos. And you get the subsonics in a way that like regular sound bars and a lot of that kind of stuff just don't give you. And so the moment they touched, there's a subsonic oomph that comes out that you don't really hear, but God, do you feel it? And I was like, thumbs up to whomever's doing the sound on that, because that was just absolutely brilliant, because you have that, you feel that connection in it, like a really visceral way that the two of them touching just gives you. And yeah.
I just loved how they let them, both the actors and the characters in the real world, be their age. So when at the very end you see both Neo and Trinity, they're getting unjacked, and they both have the shaved heads, and you're like, you can see the glittering grays and silvers in their buzzed hair. And I was like, thank you, because I'm at that stage. I'm turning gray. And I love that, you know, when you saw Neo in the Matrix, and not as much with Trinity, but definitely with Neo, you could see his white hairs in his beautiful long locks. And I thought, yes, thank you. Because people do age. It does happen. It does happen, Hollywood. And I would like to see more of that, you know.
And they're both still beautiful.
Exactly. In these beautiful, beautiful people. And I also really loved how, like, the direction was such that Neo in the real world of Io, etc., he was really animated. Unlike in the first trilogy, when Neo was in the real world, he was very subdued. He was very sort of restrained. But now he's middle-aged, and he's just like, he's marveling. He's allowed to marvel. He was allowed to be heartbroken and sad, not just like angry and restrained. You know how that patriarchal idea of masculinity, right? The toxic masculinity, mm-hmm. where you're not really allowed to be sad as a man. You can be angry though, so that's allowed. But in this film, he got to be sad. He got to be bewildered. You know, he was much more expressive, and I really appreciated that. And I liked the nuance of Keanu Reeves' performance as Neo in the real world. I really appreciated that.
You know what? I hadn't even picked up on it, but now I'm thinking back, and you're absolutely right. And I think that also maybe a little part of that comes from the fact that he is sort of like a bit less yoked with the title of being the one and the pressure of being the one, which is another thing that sort of like runs throughout the film, but mostly picks up toward the end. But like the idea that he, you know, some people never believed he was the one, himself included. Yeah. And now he's gotten to this, you know, the end, and like he already did his job. He already went to the Machine City and then died, and then now came back, and yeah, so he's kind of over all of that. So he does have the capacity to marvel at things, and he does have the capacity, like he can just be in his feels as much as he wants to, because he doesn't have all the rest of that resting on his shoulders. And then we get to the end and the part where like I absolutely lost my crap because I was just sobbing everywhere, and you know, he's not the one, because no. Trinity is right there with him. You know, Sandra, you were talking about aging as well, and that was another thing that I quite liked, is like this is 60 years later. He is at least, you know, seems like he's 20 years older,
right?
And he can't do all the same stuff that he did before, and that is perfectly fine. Like, you know, he still looks great as can be when he's doing the, you know, the kung fu and all that kind of stuff, but you know, he can't fly anymore. This has been a long time. He doesn't remember how to do it anymore. Yeah. He's, you know, he's aged. I'm not as fast as I used to be either. Like, I get this, I feel that. But then to have Trinity sort of like pick that up, that was
quite,
it was
literally too,
it was like cheesy, yeah. But yeah. I loved it.
Yeah. And like, she's I mean, that, yes, it's being, we're being hit over the head with it, but she's literally holding him up, and he's letting her hold him up. And and it's like, so yes, that's a little bit of a heavy-handed metaphor, but he's like, yeah, he's giving over to her. She can take it for that moment, and she does.
And he has no problem with it either, which is another very nice touch. Like, you don't, you know, a lesser character, a lesser movie, etc., might have, like, you know, a close-up on him gasping or even being a little bit jealous or something, and there was none of that, because they're just a team.
Yeah. And I did think it was, like, the first viewing I had, I wasn't too sure about Neo's, like, the new, I guess, power he had in the Matrix, which was like a force field, basically. But as the second viewing,
is that new? He did that in the first three movies.
I think he did before, didn't he?
It
just seemed like, to me, it seemed like it was the only thing he was doing was just like this force field. Yeah. And I thought, well, I guess in middle age, when you have a little bit more maturity, you know, it's okay to be more defensive rather than offensive, you know?
Yeah, just don't touch me.
Yeah. Don't touch me. Right. Like, so, I thought there was a lot of really interesting comments about aging and being aged, maybe.
Yeah, I love that scene where they walk out of the cafe towards the end and they say, can you fly? And he does that at 10 seconds. No, that's not happening. It was such a like.
And then even at that point, he has to start relying on Trinity, because she's the one that has the motorcycle and he's just hanging on, going for the ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's the one being active in that scene. He's protecting them, making certain that like that she's got the space to do what she needs to do, and she's the one taking them out of there. Very much so.
Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, you know, that reminds me of a line from earlier. As much as I was sad that we didn't get to see Trinity come back to herself sooner and be more kick-ass for longer in the movie, I appreciated that she always had agency. Like, she was always her own character. And that was another line that I quite liked from one of the IO scenes, when Jada Pinkett Smith is dressing down the captain and being like, you know, you're stripped of your rank, you have to go clean up your ship, et cetera, et cetera. And Neo pops out and he's just like, no, don't blame her. And part of the dressing down then that he gets is, you know, how dare you, be quiet, blah, 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 don't do this. And also, please don't strip my captain of her agency. She made this Sophie's Choice herself, which was, I think, a nice touch, because in a lot of movies and superhero narratives and stuff, you do have, even when you have a female character who is large and in charge, you know, you get somebody stepping up to be like, oh, it's not her fault. And this is just slaps that right down.
I think, and that's the benefit of having Niobe in that position, was in a way, maybe in the 1990s, that wouldn't have been a part of the story. But because we've got Niobe being, it's like, as a woman in charge, she's far more aware of that, can make that statement, it sticks. And that wouldn't have been an issue previously. Yeah, it was. No, that worked for me 100%.
I appreciated that. Like, I think because us all being Gen X women who grew up with this movie and having sort of the red pill co-opted by the patriarchy, that it just felt very right. And I think based on our last episode, it was all what we were seeking, is that ultimately the answer was partnership and equality. And like, just at the end, the closing scenes too, when they're looking out over the world and they're joking about remaking the world, and yeah, we will paint it with rainbows, and it's just like sort of trying to like take back some of that from the story. And yeah, just we want that partnership and that equality, and the two of them together making that world whatever they want it to be.
The moment that I absolutely started sobbing was the very, very end of the movie, when the music kicks up and it's the same song from the end of the original Matrix. Mm-hmm. But instead of Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine belting out those lyrics, it's a cover with a black woman singing those lyrics. And I was just like, oh, my God, you killed me. I am dead now. This is a ghost podcasting, because that was just like the perfect touch to end this movie that has been so referential to that first movie, to finish off in like a, you know, a reflection of the same way. Like, it's the same thing, but it's not quite, because it's different and better. And I just, oh my God, sorry, I'm gonna cry again, because it's so good.
And that moment that was perfect. Like, leading into the, and Erica, I totally picked up on the same thing, but leading into that music, you've got the two of them flying together, and they're orbiting each other while they fly together, like longitudinally, they're orbiting around each other as they fly towards us, and then boom, we hit that cover, and it's like, Yep, there we go. You got me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for me, like, while I decried the inconsistency with the theme of binaries, I did love that binary. Like, they're like the binary star for me, that couple, right? So I love that part. I love their binary starness together, orbiting around one another in partnership. But yeah.
It sounds like the things that didn't work for you in the movie are also a lot of the same things that didn't work for me, but the things that did work for me worked to such a ridiculous extent that it more than balanced it out. I feel like we're not really disagreeing on terms of how it worked.
I agree. I was thinking exactly the same thing. I think it's like, I don't think we've disagreed on anything, really. It's
just, we're all on your team.
We're just giving the weighting we're giving it to it. Yeah. Different bits is different for us.
We're grading on different curves.
Nice. Nicely done.
By the way, as a complete non-segue, I want to give a nod towards Jonathan Groff, who played Smith. Wow, he was good at referencing Smith, because totally 100% believable that he was Smith. He got the mannerisms, the voice, the tics completely right.
It wasn't like he was doing an impression. Like, he did a very nice job of being a different character, a different version of that same character. Same character.
Yeah, an evolved version of Smith. Like, Smith, like, that has gone through everything and has developed more.
Yeah.
I had been worried about them replacing the original actors, but I think that really worked for me, because they created the in-story reasons for different faces and different actors, and I liked it. It sort of freed them up to be a little different.
Also, yeah. the fact that we had, you know, in the original movies, Morpheus, you know, Morpheus doesn't quite create Neo, but in a way he does create Neo. And the idea that we have once again sort of flipped that around and reflected it in this movie, where Neo literally creates a Morpheus that will then recreate Neo out of this Thomas Anderson character, was just like, that was a little taste of the original Matrix, the layers upon layers upon layers of reflections and meaning and stuff. That was just it took me a little bit because I didn't know what a modal was, but I felt like the movie did a really good job of explaining it, because I picked up really fast and then was like, oh, that's why it's a different Morpheus actor. That's why. And I was worried, because when he steps out of that toilet stall and says at last in that really goofy like voice, I was like, oh no, he's overdoing it. But then it was like, no, he is, he's overdoing it literally on purpose.
Yeah, he's intentionally doing it. Yeah. No, and how good was Abdul Mateen in that? He was just I loved the way there are contrasts between him and Lawrence Fishburne, who played Morpheus in the trilogy, and like drunk Morpheus in this film, when he get given the pill and he pops up behind that desk in the key store, again, reference acknowledged. And he's drunk, he's high on that pill. And I don't think Lawrence Fishburne could have pulled that off, but he totally did.
He has too much gravitas.
Yeah, too much gravitas to be able to do that. It was like, no, he's not going to be able to do that. But he did, and it totally worked.
Yeah, well, that here, there's where I'm going to disagree. I do think that Lawrence Fishburne could have done that. my disagreement.
I'm not sure. You know what? I'm not sure if he could have pulled off those belted suits.
Okay, fair.
Oh, yeah.
Because those belted suits are like, those are tough. And you're doing it, dude.
I think Lawrence Fishburne could have pulled off the drunk acting. I just don't think I would have reacted positively to it, because he had created that character with so much gravitas that I think Morpheus literally needed a different face for me to be able to buy that scene without going, ew.
I do think that the writers could have done more with that, you know, Morpheus that Neo created, yes. that Thomas Anderson created. I think that was a lost opportunity. And that was, that's one of the things I missed. And then I also think that, I would have liked a better explanation for Smith's continued existence in the Analyst's Matrix. Cause that didn't quite work for me. Why he was still there, why he still got to run around and do whatever he wanted and all of that.
That's true. That was a little bit like, you know, there's a nice explanation of how Neo and Trinity get like rebuilt molecule by molecule and all that kind of stuff. You know, I wondered, and maybe this is just me being too much of a nerd of a bunch of different types, but I was like, okay, so they're being rebuilt after they were dead, and we have a character named Shepard. Is this a nod to Mass Effect? But that aside, I was like, you're right. They do give a pretty decent explanation for Neo and Trinity, but Agent Smith was a program. So, and he was defeated. Like, was he just, yeah, you're right. There was not, like, I could headcanon a bunch of different ways that he came back, but they didn't tell me what it was.
Yeah, I headcanoned it as they were angry at Smith and they wanted to punish him because, that's what the way I saw it. But you're right. That's me writing that into there. They didn't explain why he had to be there.
I only bring it up because I think that, like, the Morpheus, what was missing for the Morpheus story, and then this little thing about Smith. I think if they had been able to put that in, that would have just added some extra layers. And that's part of why we love this. I hate to say the word franchise, but that is, right? And so I think they could have been richer with that. And that's usually like, that's where I'm coming from. Like, I can see what it could have been. If they just moved a little bit farther along with some of the storyline possibilities.
I have a question for you guys. This is another, and it may not have been it might be something that was explained in the movie and I just didn't pick up on it because I only watched it the one time. So we have Priyanka Chopra Jones, who is great as the grown up version of Sati, and I was very happy to see that character again. But where is she? Like, what is that place where she is standing over a well? I didn't understand. Like, I definitely understood that she had information and knew stuff and was able to, like, you know, affect things in the Matrix. But where, like,
I think she is in the Matrix the same way that, I mean, this is just my feeling reality, because she was existing. Remember, she was in the noodle shop, serving.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. So I
so
think
she's in the Matrix for sure. Okay.
She's in the Matrix.
She pops up several times, doesn't she? Because she says, "I'm keeping an eye on you," and she has, like, mm-hmm. sort of different glasses and appearances. Yeah.
So what's the place with a well then? Like, is that in the Matrix?
Yeah, I think it is. I think we're supposed to just assume.
All right. Which well, is I'm glad that I didn't miss something.
Yeah, yeah. No, no. I don't. They never explained it, you know, perfectly. But it's in the Matrix because everyone has to jack in to see her. So she's like the new version of the Oracle, right? Who basically raised her.
Mm, that's true.
That's kind of the headcanon we have to create for ourselves too, right?
Is that although the Oracle she does mention her. That the Oracle has disappeared and she doesn't know where the Oracle went, which is like, to me, in terms of like massive flag signaling for sequel possibilities, it's like, where did the Oracle go?
That's true, because other people have said that the Oracle was purged.
That's
so,
right.
So, like, we've got some conflicting information there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was just a script boo-boo or if, like, oops, we forgot to change that other line.
I think it's like Sarah's saying, and we all know, they're setting up for perhaps more, right? So if the exiles with the Merovingian can survive.
and could you see chew scenery anymore?
Now they're like the homeless people or, you know, like that's an interesting comment.
Yeah. And the Merovingian did say that he would be back.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. I thought that was the weakest. I thought he was the weakest.
It made me laugh, but it went on far too long it was a little too cartoony, I thought.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. 100% agree with that.
My favorite moment was his first line, and then after there was downhill.
I feel like we've been talking for quite a long time, so I want you to think about your final thoughts. Or I'm sort of thinking there won't be a sequel. Mm. I felt like she was trying to shut that down and leave us with a nice ending.
And it's not like the box office is going to change anybody's mind at Warner Brothers.
Yeah, that's my feeling too, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's so hard with the pandemic. We can't even know how it would have done. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like, and I don't think they want to do more of them. So it's kind of a nice little treat to get a little peek back into this world. But like, how are you feeling about this as a sequel generally and... Yeah, your final thoughts. So let's start with you, Sandra, since you were middling on it.
I'm going to say that they gave it a good shot. It was a good effort. Mm-hmm. And what I'm left wondering is a line from one of the characters who says, was it a tragedy or a farce?
Well, was it?
So I'm going to say that I see more of the positive after our conversation, which I'm very happy to be in this space. And I definitely will want to rewatch with some of the comments that you, Erica, and Sarah have made.
Maybe sometime in the aftertime, we can get together, maybe even Sarah, and watch it together.
Yeah.
And like have those like squee moments together. And that'll make you feel even more positive.
Yeah, that will make me feel even better. Yeah, absolutely. So
ideally in a theater someday. Because after hearing Sarah saw it in a theater, I'm like super
I'm so jealous of that.
Yeah.
It was. No kidding. Yeah. I mean, it was. We'd just come out of our last lockdown last year. And I was on break from over the Christmas period, over the summer holidays. And so I had a morning free and I was like, you know what? I'm taking myself to the movies. And that was a few, 2.5 hours, 3 hours if you add everything else in. Well spent.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Final thoughts for you, Sarah.
Did we need this? No. If we'd had the end of the trilogy be Matrix Revolutions, that would have been enough. It would have been enough. So, did I need this? Did we need this? No. Did I enjoy it? Did I love the fact that it got made? Oh, God, yes. Yes, as we all mentioned, Lana Wachowski, that woman had some righteous anger going on. But as a fan, I loved it. I loved that she was going, yeah, we see you. You know what we're talking about. I enjoyed it. Were there bits, as we've discussed, that I thought, yeah, that could have been done better? Would I wanted more of this, less of this? Yes, 100%. But did I enjoy it? Yes. Did it bring back the love that I had for the originals? Yes. So, yeah, thumbs up for me. And I'm glad this exists rather than not.
Erica.
I'm going to say I did need this. Which might be part of why I'm so willing to overlook some of the flaws, because I think I really genuinely did. You know, at the end of the first trilogy, you have, you know, the Sati, the little Sati, saying, you know, I'd like Neo. Do you think we'll get to see him again? And the Oracle saying, I wouldn't be at all surprised, or, you know, something to that effect. And, like, I think because of that, I have just always had this, like, little open space in my heart to be like, there's room for more. And, you know, I'm not sure that even Lana Wachowski agrees with me there. But but I really, I feel like I needed a little extra taste, especially, you know, after these last few years, which have really sucked. I emotionally wanted to just reconnect with something that made me very, very happy. And that is exactly what I did through this movie. And I think one of the reasons that I was able to be so positive about it here today is because I just watched it the one time. And I'm sure that as I watch it more and more, I will see more of the flaws. And after talking about it here with you guys, I definitely recognize the holes and the gaps and the cracks and stuff more. But I'm still, like, you know, just desperately clinging on to the joy, because it was really like it hit the serotonin and dopamine buttons for me quite a lot at a time that I really, really needed it. And I want to read off a quote from Lena Wachowski talking about the origins of the story. I'm just pulling this straight off of Wikipedia. But she said, I couldn't have my mom and dad, yet suddenly I had Neo and Trinity, arguably the two most important characters in my life. It was immediately comforting to have these two characters alive again. And it's super simple. You can look at it and say, okay, these two people die, and okay, bring these two people back to life. And oh, doesn't that feel good? Yeah, it did. It's simple. And this is what art does, and this is what stories do. They comfort us, and they're important. And I just feel like that is a perfect echo for the way that I felt about it. I needed to be comforted by reuniting with these characters that I love, and watching those two characters that I love reunite with each other just did it for me. So I'm happy.
Nice.
That is good. I feel like when the first time I watched it, I was so overwhelmed. It's just like, I love this series so much. And I just couldn't even like take it all in, and I had to watch it again so quickly afterwards. And I, after watching it a third time, I'm going in the opposite direction, Erica. I'm loving it more. Despite good. The flaws, just because, like, oh, I'm seeing what they're doing, and it's like, I think they did something that is really hard to do with a sequel, especially one this long after, and where you're just doing sort of the same thing again as fan service. I think they managed to fan service and try to do something different. And I agree, Sandra, it's not as deep or as like all encompassing, but I still think it just, I can't do complicated right now. So
yeah, fair.
You know, and the moment the whole love story started coming together, I was just like sitting there going, even the first time, going like, we were right. I feel so seen.
Smug.
And I felt really proud of us. So, yeah. And I couldn't wait. I was like, I'm so excited to talk about this with all of you.
I can't help thinking in terms of the love story, and this is, you know, Agents of Smooch. So I can't help thinking that if it were a romance writer who had been involved in the script, it would have been enemies to lovers.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Classic.
That's how the analyst would have set them up, Tiffany and Thomas.
That would have been good. Now I'm picturing it and I'm a little sad. Oh, I'm sure we could talk about this forever, and maybe we'll go see this movie together someday. That would be fun.
Hooray.
But until next time, stay safe, agents. Agents of Smooch is part of the Incomparable Network. If you are enjoying our show, please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the Smooch Agency, you can become a member of the Incomparable at theincomparable.com/members. Members can choose to support us and any other shows on the network, and you get extra perks like hanging out in the members-only Slack channel and bonus content such as our growing list of incomprehensible Agents of Smooch tipsy commentaries. Thank you for listening. Your next mission will be coming to you soon.